married couples. And I'm going to pick up and have a little bit more to say in that area. The have this slide up, and it's one of several that I had, and we could spend a great deal of time looking at scriptures about adultery, warning against adultery, warning against its consequences, because the scriptures address that so many times, and it's because it is so easy on the one hand, so readily available, so attractive in the philosophies and the thinking of worldly people. There was a connection drawn between that in the lesson about idolatry on Sunday and the morals of the people involved in idolatry. Very often promiscuity is connected with idolatry. Very often fertility rights and various aspects of sexual behavior are tied into idolatry. And it's an area where we need constant, I think, reaffirmation and encouragement to stay on the road, to keep the path of chastity, of holiness, of faithfulness, of monogamy, or of complete absence of sexual behavior in the absence of a marital relationship. I also pointed out on this particular scripture passage the admonition, "My son, keep your father's commands and do not forsake your mother's teaching," the opening lines there, because this is going to be pertinent. It's pertinent here in this area, and I stressed in closing yesterday how important it is that parents talk to their children about morality, that parents drive home the lessons of good behavior, good ethics, good decisions. And it goes, as is indicated in these opening verses, it goes back to the same principle expressed in the sixth chapter of Deuteronomy. Good behavior and good moral values are things that need to be talked about constantly, because there is a constant barrage of information and misinformation that undermines this kind of teaching, and we need constant reinforcement on these things. And I have always been open to, if I'm listening to the radio and the family's in the car and something comes on the radio, whether it's talk or music, that I deem inappropriate or bad in some way, I'm inclined to start talking about it. And likewise, if the television is on and something comes on that isn't good, I'm inclined to start talking about it. Maybe railing against it, maybe discussing it, but at any rate, letting my perspective be known. And I think that's very appropriate in the context of the family, in the context of the church family. I think that's appropriate to not let things just go by that are inherently wrong or destructive, and sometimes let people who are perhaps immature formed assume the worst on the basis of silence. There needs to be a lot of talk within the family. When you walk, when you are prepared to go to sleep at night, you have to have these things open in your conversation, parents to children, certainly, and children to children as well. My oldest son did a lot of instructing of his younger brothers, passing on things that he had already learned, and that's a good thing. Encourage one another with words. That's a little bit of an abbreviation of a couple of phrases that Paul uses, but good marriages, like most worthwhile endeavors, require hard work. The partnership works well because the partners trust each other, and both work for success and the other's welfare. And it's certainly very difficult to have an effective marriage, a satisfying marriage, if either of the partners is not willing to participate and to contribute. Marriages work well when each work for success. Now, there may be times in the best of marriages when one or the other is just not that excited about the relationship and about where they are in life, and one of the partners has to carry more weight and has to work harder. That's actually a pretty normal kind of phenomenon to go through. There are episodes in most relationships, including marriage relationship, where sometimes somebody has to carry an unshare fare of the burden and work a little harder, or maybe even a lot harder, to get through some rough places and rough times. Each partner contributes to the success of the family with their own skills and strengths, and a partner's contributions are complimented and admired. And I'm about to go to a fairly predictable passage on that score, but it's really important in human relationships and within the family, and right now I'm talking particularly about the husband and wife, the parents, but it's also important in the vertical relationships there between parents and children, that we have the good grace to compliment things that are worthy of complimenting. that we have the good grace to give encouragement for things that we enjoy, things that we approve of, things that are done well, sacrifices that are made. There is a great value in that, in building and strengthening relationships. Contributions should be complimented, should be admired, and a healthy marriage needs verbal support and expressions of admiration and gratitude. And I've seen the converse, and so have you. I've seen it a lot of times. I've seen a lot of marital relationships where there is so much negativity in the things that people say to each other that there's a constant edge and a constant friction. And maybe one is the source, maybe it's mutual, but there is a tremendous need for endearments, for positive words in relationships between parents and also extended into the parent-child relationship, a great need for positive reinforcement, and that extends into the church too. We need that from each other. We need affirmation from each other. And a corollary to that, we need to be able to take compliments. We need to be able to accept compliments. Sometimes that's hard to do, sometimes that's embarrassing, and sometimes we put on such a show of humility in when we receive compliments that it almost embarrasses the person that was trying to give us the encouragement and the compliment in the first place. And that's not a good thing. It's a little bit like the way hospitality works. You know, hospitality is kind of a two-way street. It's great if people will open their home to you and welcome you in, but it's great if you, as a guest, are reciprocating by letting them know that you appreciate it and letting them know that it's a good thing, being a good guest as well as having a good host. And so it also is with verbal affirmations. We need to be good recipients of the encouragements of others within the family, within the church. We need to be good recipients to be thankful for the encouragement given and no need to turn it into a burden when someone gives us a compliment. In Proverbs, the 31st chapter, and I'm not going to go in detail over the passage here, but in Proverbs, the 31st chapter, we have what is commonly described as the first line there, a wife of noble character being described. Verses 10 through 31, and as the writer here affirms, a wife of noble character is of value beyond calculation. This is a priceless thing to have, is a wife who is of noble character. A wife of noble character who can find. Well, Solomon seemed to have issues with that because in the book of Ecclesiastes, and by the way, how many wives and concubines did Solomon have? 1,000. Nice round 1,000. 700 wives and 300 concubines. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, he wrote a line, he wrote, one man in 1,000, but not one woman, which was to imply that by the time he got to the place that he had 1,000 at his bequest, that none of them were very satisfying to him at all. He's there talking about someone you can trust, someone you can lean on. One man in 1,000, he said, but not one woman. Well, I suppose I must have that 1,001th woman. And some others among you, I think, would consider that you have found that very rare commodity, that very rare jewel, the wife of noble character. I did. I'm very thankful for that I have been blessed with a wife of noble character. She is worth more than rubies. Her husband has full confidence in her and lacks nothing of value. And that's the kind of relationship you want to be able to have, where you have full confidence in your spouse. This, again, is stated in the masculine. It's a father addressing his son. But we can appreciate how important it is to be able to have full confidence in the one to whom you're married, where trust is not a big issue. She brings him good, not harm, all the days of her life. And that's a really important concept going into marriage, and it's an important concept to reinforce all through marriage, that your best interest is your spouse's best interest. That what's best for your spouse is best for you, and you should always seek what is best for your spouse. Most of us have probably been in a situation where one spouse is tearing down the other one. Maybe they have a habit of doing that. They have a habit of just telling you all the things that's wrong with their spouse, all the things that's wrong with the person they're married to. Do you suppose they have a very happy relationship? See, grumbling and complaining are things that God is not fond of at all. It's something that he really addresses over and over again in the Scriptures. We're enjoined to have a thankful attitude. And sometimes you have to work on finding things to be thankful for. But I have observed in real-life circumstances that as we pursue an attitude of thankfulness, we find ourselves with more and more reasons to actually be thankful. That it tends to be the idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You look for the good and you reinforce the good and the good gets better. and other things tend to get better as well. And she brings him good, not harm, all the days of her life. The wife who undermines her husband or the husband who undermines his wife are really attacking their own flesh. They're really, the idea Paul says, if you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out or you will be consumed by each other. And that certainly is applicable not only in the church, but in the family relationship. And he goes on to talk about how industrious she is. She selects wool and flax and works with eager hands. She's a producer. She is making things that are of value to her family. Like the merchant ships bringing her food from afar, she gets up while it's still dark. She provides food for her family and portions for her servant girls. And I'm glad that it's her that gets up before dark and does all that, because I don't want to do all that. You know, I don't want to get up at those hours of the morning and do all that. But she gets up and she is very, very diligent to take care of her family. She considers a field and buys it. This woman is a very industrious woman. She also is the kind of woman that a lot of women wanted to become during the sort of the feminist revolution, you know, the rise of feminism and all that. And that didn't all work out in the best possible way. There were a lot of motives, a lot of things going on there, and some of the fruit that we're reaping from that in our own generation here in our current time are not the best. But the woman pictured here is industrious. She is an earner for the family. And in fact, in most of human history, in one way or another, the woman has been an earner for the family. If you think about farm life in our own American history, the woman was an active partner in terms of making sure there was enough food for the family to eat, in terms of making sure that the things around the farmstead itself were taken care of. There were a lot of ways in which she was directly involved in the production of the food and meeting the needs of the family. We have scriptures that speak to the idea of men having a particular responsibility to care for their family. We're going to talk about that in a few days. Not there yet, but we do have some scriptures that address a particular responsibility on the part of men to take care of their family. But this is a partnership that we're talking about here. She considers a field and buys it. She's involved in the financial well-being of her family. She sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for a task. She sees that her trading is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She's up early. She's up late. She's trying to meet the needs of the family. And husbands and wives, fathers and mothers need to sacrifice, need to work hard and need to sacrifice to see to it that the family is taken care of. And in our day and time, you know, we've got a lot of conveniences, a lot of time-saving machinery, and so some of the ways that time is spent may vary from the way they have been in the past, but there is still a great need for time investment in the family. It's very easy. Last night in the living room at the house where I'm staying, there were three guys sitting there with three laptop computers in their lap, you know, all online at the same time. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of conversation going on between the three of us. We're all sitting there looking at these screens, and we each had our own reasons for being, for having the computers running and either being online or working on other things. But that kind of stuff intrudes on the family. That kind of stuff intrudes on time spent together. And it's possible to have hours spent in the evening in the same household and no interaction, no communication, no talking together, no sharing of any kind going on. We have to be wary of that. When I'm talking about parents and children, I'm going to start that, I think, today and continue it tomorrow. One of the things that we really need to be conscious of is being sure that the time that the family spends together actually is together. There's a real need for family interaction, for family time together. And that was maybe a little more obvious sometimes in the past, although people have always been able to get caught up in work to where they ignored other things or caught up in other interests and ignored various things. It goes on in this passage in Proverbs to describe her as being very generous. She opens her arms to the poor, and that's a good quality to have in our families as well. It's certainly a quality endorsed in the Christian family. When it snows, she has no fear because she's taking care of her family. She has them clothed in scarlet. And coming down to verse 23, her husband is respected at the city gate. Well, why the city gate? What happens at the city gate in those times? Judgment takes place, all right? That's where the elders, the leaders of the city, the wise men of the city sit in the city gate, and their problems are brought to them. Their contracts are witnessed. Their issues are settled. And he is respected in the city gate, and she has a role in that because she has made it part of her job as a wife to help him look good. And men need wives that help them look good. We all need somebody that will stand with us, that will help us to be better than we might be on our own. Her husband is respected at the city gate where he takes his seat among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them, supplies the merchants, and so forth. Verse 26, she speaks with wisdom and faithful instruction is on her tongue. She is a teacher. She is an example and a teacher of others. She watches over the affairs of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. And households need to be watched over. Families, household, family, same thing. The family needs to be watched over. It needs shepherding. It needs guiding. And it's not just a father's responsibility to do that. Mothers have to watch over the family, have to be overseers, shepherds of their family, of their children. Her children arise and call her blessed, and her husband also, and he praises her. And I want to reemphasize that principle there in the 28th verse. It has been said, and I don't remember the man's name, but it has been said that the best thing that a man can do for his children is to love their mother. And not simply to love her in some emotional sense, but to let it be known, to make it obvious that he loves their mother. And this is exhorting that idea that the wife of good character, she deserves to be praised by her children. And one of the reasons her children do that is because her husband does that. He praises her. And so her children speak well of her also. If a husband speaks badly of his wife, do you think his children are going to learn to admire her, respect her, and look up to her the way that they should? The father sets the tone in the family in so many ways. And it's important that he set the tone, that the mother is honored by her children so that her children arise and call her blessed. Her husband also, he praises her. And then we have some instances, examples there of the kind of thing he says about her and how this great quality in verse 30, which goes to the idea of appropriate adornment that was talked about on Monday night, that a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. This is the kind of mate that all of us should want to have and should be glad if we do have. A woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her the reward she has earned and let her works bring her praise at the city gate. That she, not only does he deserve honor at the gate, but so does she because of the way she conducts herself, the way she is industrious and provides for her family. Marriages require submission. Two cannot become one without both submitting. Wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord, and it goes on from there. Submission cannot be done grudgingly. This is not a passage that deals with the idea of husbands forcing their wives to do what they want. It's a passage that lays out the idea of women being willing to follow the lead of a husband that they respect and admire. There was some conversation I was involved in on Monday about Adam and Eve and the challenges that would have been involved in building a relationship from ground zero. But it seems to me that God actually set up a little situation there that was in favor of giving them something to talk about for the first few minutes of their relationship, you know? Because what happened before God made Eve? Well, God gave Adam some instructions for one thing, and he gave Adam the opportunity to name a whole bunch of animals. The various kinds of animals were named by Adam before Eve was created. And so when Eve was created, they right away had something to talk about after his initial enthusiasm began to wane, you know. They had something to talk about. He had some things to tell her to start building their relationship. Some things that God had told him as far as their instructions on how to conduct themselves in the garden, and some things that he'd already done by way of naming the animals. And she could go ooh and ah when he said, you know, I called that one a rhinoceros. You want to know why? And it gave them something to interact about. He got to play the role of a teacher. She got to play the role of a student, which is to say she would submit to him in a willing and appropriate way while he got to be in a position of not huge, heavy-handed leadership, but he got to be in the forefront a little bit. And it was a good relationship-building beginning that God laid the groundwork for there. He playing the role of teacher, she playing the role of student, and going from there, so that they had things to talk about. They had a beginning to the kind of relationship that they were going to build on. The man is called on especially. The woman is called on especially to submit. The man is called on especially to accept the responsibility of leading in love. That's the word that's used over and over again in Ephesians 5 for the man's responsibility. He's got it to him. He needs to love her. And we could talk about the aspects of human nature, male and female. Be prepared, husbands, to give your life for your wife. You need to do that as a choice so that if it ever comes to an issue, you've already made that choice. And then, again, the emphasis on submission and respect in regard to the wife's attitude toward her husband. The husband is to love his wife as he loves himself, therefore to treat her as he wants to be treated. This is a special application of the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Treat your wife as you would treat your own body, taking care of her, nourishing, nurturing, caring for her. Husbands and wives are not to be in competition. This is completely ruled out in this scripture as in others. Nor are they the same. And that's an important thing to keep in mind with some of the kinds of shifts in attitude that have occurred in our culture. Husbands and wives, men and women, are not the same. We may have equal value. There may be a lot of things we can do equally well. There may be places where either has some advantage, some areas where a woman is going to have advantages over a man, some where a man is going to have advantages over a woman. They say, this came up into my mind at lunchtime because I was sitting by several men, and there was a side conversation that started up. I was conversing with Keith, and John was conversing with a couple of other guys, and the side conversation is going on, and I'm talking with Keith, but I'm hearing snippets of what's being said in the side conversation there, and John said something about me being a multitasker. But all I was hearing was snippets. Now, had one of the opposite sex been sitting there, I bet she would have known what was going on in both conversations for sure. And I don't say that facetiously. Women are demonstrated to be better multitaskers than men are. There are differences in the way our brains function, as well as in a lot of other things about us. But women are demonstrated to be better at multitasking than men are. Men tend to have a narrower... There's lots of things that are different between men and women that make us complementary to each other and make it possible for us to be mutually supportive. The woman is to support her marriage, her husband, with respect. That goes back to the passages from Proverbs 31 there. If you're busy as a wife building up your husband and trying to make him look good, that reinforces your own respect for him. And I have seen this, again, I've seen this played out in life. I have seen the circumstances of the negativity played out where each just chips away at the other, or where one frequently chips away at the other. And those kinds of things are very hard to correct as the years go by. I have seen a man who had a habit of tearing his wife down after many years of marriage, do some reading, do some thinking, and decide, well, I need to do better, and really try to start treating her better and speaking better of her and becoming complimentary of her. But by that time, she had become so embittered that she basically just brushed off everything he said. She just kind of let it slide on by because it just seemed like another kind of manipulative thing that he was doing, and she couldn't believe that it was real. And that's a very sad place to come to, where that kind of hardness has developed. And just don't go there. Just don't let that happen. Make sure that you work on the respect and the admiration and the mutual love and support, love on the part of the husbands and submission, respect on the part of the wives. The man is to support his marriage, his wife, with love. Husbands and wives should want each other to look good, should want other people to see the strength and the quality of their partner. The key words for a successful marriage, according to Paul here, are love, submit, and respect. Okay, submit, love, and respect. And I will read the shorter passage from Colossians 3:18 and 19. This is a parallel passage written at the same time, but a much briefer discussion of the topic. In Colossians 3:18 and 19, Paul said, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives. And do not be bitter, do not be harsh toward them." He emphasizes the fact that husbands are not supposed to be in charge of the family because they're bigger or stronger or meaner, but they love their wives, and they want what's best for their wives, and the leadership is there only because a wife is willing to submit to her husband. He's talking about a willing cooperation here that is for the benefit of the whole family. Now, husbands and wives have duties to each other. One responsibility, and maybe this is two, but I think it's one. One responsibility is to provide healthy satisfaction of sexual drives and emotional needs. Again, each spouse is to have a goal of providing satisfaction to the other and being satisfied with each other. Marriage is the one place for sexual activity and the satisfaction of sexual desires. Because sexual drives are often strong, most people need to be married and to stay married. When Paul is advocating being single as a great choice, he frankly says, not a lot of people can handle that. All right, it's a very powerful drive in human beings. Most people need to be married and stay married. Maintaining a healthy marriage helps people maintain purity and avoid the damage of sexual sin. People are to consider marriage as a permanent and unbreakable commitment and do everything they can to keep a marriage working. Even spiritual needs may be met through a marriage that has survived stress and strain. And Paul writes about this in the 7th chapter of 1 Corinthians. And I'm not going to go over this whole passage. I'm just going to look at a couple of portions of it here. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, beginning in verse 1, we have Paul saying, "For the matters you wrote about, it's good for a man not to marry." And please don't dismiss what he says there. It's good for a man not to marry. That's a statement of fact. "But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife to her husband." We've got to take care of each other, each other's physical and emotional needs in that relationship. "The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer, then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." The Corinthians, like Americans, lived in a sexually charged environment, and they needed to be sure that they had the equipment that they needed to stay pure in that environment. And a healthy marriage relationship, that was a good equipping for being able to stay pure in that environment. And so Paul instructed them in that regard, and this teaching, the wife's body belongs to her husband, and the husband's body belongs to his wife, that epitomizes the idea of marriage. You know, the two became one flesh, each caring for the other, trying to please the other, each realizing that their own well-being is strongly tied to the well-being of their spouse, each wanting, again, to please the other. And when he says, don't deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, husbands and wives should not use sexual relations as bargaining chips, as PowerPoints. This is one of the things, other kind of PowerPoint. This is one of the things that was wrong with sexuality in the Roman Empire, is that pretty much sexuality in the Roman Empire was about power. And in biblical worldview, it's about relationship and cooperation. But to a great extent in the Roman Empire, sexuality was about power, and what passed for marriage in the Roman Empire was largely about power. About making alliances that were to your advantage and being able to have dominance over other people, whether of the same sex or of a different sex. The view of sex in the philosophy of the age there was very perverted. And, well, look around at where we are and realize that these kinds of teachings are still very needful, very necessary to be reinforced in the world in which we now live. That we need to have a biblical worldview regarding the behavior of husband and wife and the purity that needs to be maintained and the role that marriage can have for many people, for most people, in maintaining that purity as well as finding some other advantages. Now, before I go to that, I had a question that was given to me or was put in the box yesterday regarding what I said about divorce and remarriage and adultery yesterday, and I'm going to touch on that. I'm going to revisit that a little bit, but I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on it. In Matthew 19, Jesus said that if a man divorced his wife for some reason other than adultery and married again, then he would be committing adultery. And if he divorced his wife for some reason other than adultery and she married someone else, then she would be, or the man marrying her would commit adultery. There's a similar teaching in the 5th chapter of Matthew. The two teachings together give us this picture, which, as I stated yesterday, either when there's a divorce, either the divorce has been caused by adultery, or else if there's a divorce where no adultery has occurred and the divorcees remarry, then there is adultery in remarrying. Okay, so divorce, marriage, divorce, remarriage always involves adultery. Either the divorce has been caused by adultery, or else the divorcees engage in adultery when they marry, when they have divorced without being caused by adultery. Okay. I don't see any way around those teachings on the part of Jesus. And so the question comes up, you know, when is it appropriate for someone to be divorced and remarried? And the implication, because of what Jesus says and doesn't say there in Matthew 19, the implication is that if someone is married and their partner commits adultery and they divorce them for adultery, then they remarry without committing adultery. The one who has not committed adultery, and they marry again, the implication is that they have not committed adultery by doing that. All right? And that's something for us to always bear in mind. I don't like to really emphasize too much the escape clauses, if you will, for marriage and divorce and remarriage. I don't really like to emphasize too much because the consistent biblical message is make your marriage work. Be faithful to each other. Make your marriage work. Work on this, you know, to the utmost of your ability. And my advice, okay, this I don't have chapter and verse, but there is statement to this effect here in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter. I don't have chapter and verse that says this as such, but I do look at 1 Corinthians 7:27. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Do not seek a wife. And I think that's sound advice for anyone who's been divorced. I think it's good advice to realize that not everyone's going to, because of the very thing that Paul said in the first couple of verses here, I realize not everyone's going to be able to live with that teaching. Since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife, each woman her own husband. It's better to marry than to burn, as the statement has it. Oh, I realize that that's not going to work for everyone. But that is my first advice to anyone who has been through a broken marriage, no matter what the cause of the break was. My first advice is don't remarry. Stay single, be faithful to the Lord, and live a celibate life. I have a variety of reasons for taking that position. One is that it's biblically sound in terms of being safe and morally upright. Another is that I have seen, and I bet you have too, that people tend to make similar mistakes in a second marriage to the mistakes they made in a first marriage. When they have divorced and they marry again, they tend to recapitulate the mistakes they made the first time around. Now, is that always the case? No. I've known people who had a second marriage, who have a second marriage, that worked very well. They found a more appropriate partner, and things have gone very well for them, and they've been faithful in the Lord. And I'm not trying to paint with too broad a brush, but I have seen a number of instances where people have married a second time only to recapitulate the kind of mistake they made the first time, marrying someone who really, even though they don't seem to see it, really is much like the person they were miserable with before the divorce. So that's my most basic advice. Now, when that's not going to be workable, yes, I agree that if you have an unfaithful spouse and that's the basis of your divorce, then you have a right to remarry. And as Paul goes on to discuss in the 7th chapter of 1 Corinthians here, there may be a situation where you have a faithful, believing wife or husband who has an unbelieving husband or wife, and they may leave. And if they leave, Paul says, you're not bound in such a situation. Well, there's a lot of debate about whether that means you're free to remarry. There's a lot of discussion about it, but frankly, it probably doesn't very often matter very much, because very rarely is someone who's an unbeliever and leaves a marriage going to remain chaste and single. But I would say, as long as there is a rational chance of rekindling a relationship, of reviving a relationship, it's a good thing to keep that door open as long as it is possible to retrieve, to rebuild a marriage. And the scriptures teach plainly, and there are people who teach contrary to this, but the scriptures teach plainly that as far as God's concerned, if two people divorce and one or both of them marry someone else, the door is shut on ever going back and rebuilding the original relationship. You cannot do that. It is an abomination. It is detestable to God. It's treating marriage as some kind of a lottery game or something, and God is not in any way in favor of that. If people have married inappropriately, if people have married when they should not have married, if someone has been divorced and they remarry and committed adultery, I don't see the scriptures using phrases like living in adultery. I do see the scriptures teaching the need for repentance and renewal. And I see the scriptures teaching that marriages are never to be cavalierly ended as far as God is concerned. That if a marriage has been made, we are to make the best of that marriage. We are to strengthen that marriage. And see, I don't want to present a doctrine that sounds in any way like the teaching of indulgences. And if you don't know what that is, it's being given permission ahead of time to sin. You know, when David sinned with Bathsheba, he committed adultery. What did he follow it up with? Murder. And when he's confronted by Nathan the prophet, what came next? God confronted him, okay, through Nathan the prophet. And how did David respond? I've sinned against God. Okay. And Nathan says, your sin is forgiven. Don't worry about that. Your sin is forgiven. But, boy, are you going to have problems in your family and in your kingdom for the rest of your life because of what you've done. And the child that was conceived in this one-night stand that you had, the child's going to die because people have to know that God did not approve what David had done. Now, what was David forgiven of when Nathan talked to him there? Was he forgiven of adultery or was he forgiven of murder? Yes, he was. That's right. Yes, he was. He was forgiven adultery and he was forgiven murder. Did God say, you can't have that woman? It's too late to not have that woman. A marriage has been made, and a polygamous marriage at that, but it's too late to not have that woman. It's too late to go back and undo what's been done. And who ends up on the throne of Israel and in the authorized, if you will, lineage of Christ, the kingly lineage of Christ? The son of Bathsheba, and he is named that way, isn't he, in the book of Matthew. And I was tempted to spend a little time there in the first chapter of Matthew on the genealogy of Jesus, because five women are mentioned in that genealogy. Who are they? Tamar is the first one mentioned, and who is Tamar? She's the one who seduced her father-in-law Judah and had twin sons with her father-in-law Judah. Okay, she dressed like a harlot, dressed like a prostitute, went out when he was going to go by and got him to give her a token payment, an earnest, actually, so that he would lie with her and she would conceive and have a child. Okay, she wanted a baby really bad. And so that's what she did. Tamar is mentioned in that lineage. Who else? Rahab. That's not her whole name. What's the rest of her name? The harlot. Okay, Rahab the harlot. She's mentioned that way repeatedly in the scriptures. Not only in the account in Joshua, but she's mentioned that way in the New Testament. Rahab the harlot. Don't forget. Well, one of these bright, upstanding leaders in Judah married that woman. He married Rahab the prostitute and had a child with her. And we step down a generation, and who's the next woman that's mentioned there? Ruth. What was she distinct? What was distinctive about her? She's a Moabite, okay? She's a Moabite. She's also a widow, okay? She is a Moabite widow. Her husband of the tribe of Judah should never have married her according to the law of Moses, because Moabites were excluded from the congregation of Israel after the episode in the desert with the seduction involving Balaam. No Moabites in the congregation of Israel, but nevertheless, here comes Ruth and aligns herself with Naomi, and it's a beautiful love story. It's been pointed out that that's one of the few books in the Bible that has a story, and there's no bad guy in the story. There's no villains in the story. But it's a story that was necessary, because who wouldn't know that King David had Moabites in his recent ancestry? Who wouldn't know that? And so it was important that that story be included, because here we have now the king, the dynasty, the house of David, and there's Moabites in this lineage. And not only is she a Moabite, but how did she attract the attention of the man she married? Her mother-in-law told her what to do. She slept at his feet. He'd been partying. It's the end of harvest. He'd been partying. He'd eaten. He'd drunk. He was feeling really good, it says in the story. And she went in the dark and pulled the covers up from his feet, laid down at his feet, and pulled this over herself. And during the night, he's rolling over, and he realizes there's somebody there. And he sits up and finds out Ruth is there. And they have a little conversation. And he says, I'm really flattered that you didn't try to go after one of the young men. So obviously he's not one of the young men. I'm really flattered that you came to me rather than going to one of the young men. And I would like to do for you what you want. But, he says, and she offers herself to him right then, right there. That's how I read the text. Take me. Okay, he's ready. She's ready. She offers herself to him right then and there. But he says, there's someone who's a closer relative than I am. We have to give him the opportunity under the Levirate redemption law. We have to give him the opportunity to take the inheritance, to take you as his wife. Of course, he stacks the deck so that the other guy won't choose to do that. But that's just part of the elegance and romance of the story. But he tells her, go ahead and sleep here for the night. But he makes sure they wake up early in the morning while it's still dark and there's nobody around. And he fills her shawl with grain and sends her away and says, don't tell anybody you were here. Why did he go through all that rigmarole? What was he concerned about? Her reputation. He was concerned about her. Not only is she a Moabite, but she spent the night there, you know, and her reputation is in question. The next woman in the genealogy there. Bathsheba, only I think Matthew names her as Uriah's wife. Doesn't he? Uriah's wife. Yeah, and we already know what the issue was there. And then we come to the fifth woman in the genealogy. Who's that? Mary. What problem did she have? She's an unmarried woman expecting a child. Now, do you suppose in the community of Nazareth, a little community of several hundred people, but that's all, just a few hundred people, do you suppose that was a secret that Mary was with child? We know it wasn't a secret because Joseph found out about it. And he didn't want to make a big deal of it. He wanted to end their contract for marriage quietly, but he found out about it, so everybody knew about it. It was common knowledge. And Joseph did something kind of interesting. After the angel Gabriel appeared and talked to Joseph, assuring him that this was God's hand, Joseph did something kind of interesting. He went ahead and took Mary home as his wife, but what does Matthew say he didn't do? He did not have a sexual relationship with her until when? Until after the birth of her firstborn son. If that was a firstborn, there must have been another, but that's also in the Gospels. But he didn't until after the birth of her firstborn son. Do you remember the passage in the third chapter of John where John says, I'm the bridegroom and Jesus is the, excuse me, I'm the friend of the bridegroom and Jesus is the bridegroom, right? Where John's talking about that. And John says, I'm thrilled that the bridegroom has come. I'm not disappointed. He says, the friend of the bridegroom waits to hear the bridegroom's voice. Do you know what that means? What custom lay behind that? Well, I'll tell you what custom lay behind that rather than just, you know, haphazard here. But the custom that lay behind that was the way they did marriage ceremonies there. They have a big party. Okay, we've got other scriptures that speak to that. The wedding feast in Cana. I have other scriptures that speak to that. They have a big party. And after having the partying, probably the evening of the first night, not necessarily, but probably the evening of the first night, the bridegroom takes his bride and they go into the bedroom. And the friend, the best man, stands at the door of the bedroom where they've gone. And after the bride and bridegroom have consummated their marriage in the marriage bed, the bridegroom says, "We're married." And the friend of the bridegroom hears that and relays it to the rest of the party. Would you all be comfortable with that custom? But that was the custom of the day. And John refers to that when he talks about hearing the voice of the bridegroom. Okay? Back the track up to Joseph. Joseph took Mary home as his wife. There must have been some ceremony. But what didn't happen? You see, when Joseph did not lie with Mary, when Joseph did not have conjugal relations with Mary, that wasn't a secret either. There was no secret in that either, because the friend of the bridegroom would have told everyone they have consummated the marriage. Didn't happen. He didn't consummate the marriage. And so that was not secret either in the community of Nazareth. And do you think that would have been a subject of rumor? Do you think that would have been a subject of gossip and people talking about what kind of a deal is this and what happened and so on and so forth? It would have eliminated one speculation. Do you know what the speculation would have eliminated? That Joseph had fathered the child before they legitimately came together. It would have eliminated that speculation. It would have left Mary open to a lot of other speculation, but it would have eliminated the speculation that Joseph was the actual father of the child. It would have been common knowledge that's not really Joseph's boy because of the way he carried through on that. Now, that's a little bit of a side story, but I've been talking about because of the question here, the idea of divorce, marriage, remarriage. The Lord has shown us that he can accept people from all kinds of circumstances. And I bring up David and Bathsheba because I have facetiously suggested from time to time, or sarcastically suggested from time to time, that perhaps the crime of murder is better than the crime of adultery. Because David murdered Uriah and was forgiven and accepted and not told to divorce Bathsheba. But of course it's not. I'm not honestly suggesting anything of the sort. But the truth is, God knows how to forgive people who do what? Who what? Repent. Yeah. God knows how to forgive people who repent. And very often, in the case of divorce and remarriage, when adultery has occurred, repentance is kind of hard to come by. If you've got a good relationship, and if you, especially if you've had children in that relationship, it can be a little hard to come by repentance. But I recently had a woman communicate with me, a woman I do not know, communication via the internet, describing a circumstance that she was in. And she married, and she loves the man she married, but she has been filled with regret for years because this is unresolved in her heart, that she had no legitimate right to marry him in the first place, having a previous broken marriage. And she's agonized with this for years and years and years, going through the motions of marriage, but agonizing over a guilty conscience. And God doesn't want us to live with guilty consciences. He does want us to repent of things we've done wrong. He does want us to set things right as best we can. There are things in our past that we may not be able to set right, and a faulty marriage may be one of those. But he is gracious and loving and forgiving. And we don't ever want to present the idea that it's no big deal to commit adultery and get on with life. It's a big deal. It's tragic. It's fraught with all kinds of difficulties and complications. But the God who designed us saw sin enter into the picture, knows the frailty of mankind, sent his Son to deal with the reality of sin and its consequences. And he will forgive. Chapter 1 Corinthians verses 32 through 34. Regarding marriage, Paul says, I would like you to be free from concern. I alluded to this passage a couple of days ago. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. Is that good? Isn't that great? To be concerned about the Lord's affairs and how you can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. Should he be? He should be. What kind of a marriage is it going to be if he's not? He should be. The scriptures speak to that. But it creates a more complicated situation. I have often thought how blessed the church was in the first century to have men like Paul and Barnabas and Timothy who would devote everything they had to preaching the gospel. And you tell me, and believe me, I'm not into bargain hunting when it comes to using the Lord's money to do the Lord's work, but you tell me, you know, where do you get more bang for your buck, supporting a Paul who travels all by himself, or else with a bunch of co-workers who are going to be out there spending all their time in the field, or supporting a man with a family? Now, I've got a family myself, so, you know, I'm. But just looking at the use of resources, this was a great thing. If Paul went out there and he says in 2 Corinthians, there were times when I was really hungry in my work for the Lord. Well, you know what? With my wife, I don't want to put her in that circumstance. A couple weeks ago, I was on my way to San Jose. I know the way to San Jose very, very well. And as I was on the way to San Jose, I ran over with my pickup truck. I ran over an object in the road. I do not know what it was. I didn't see it until I was right on top of it. I ran it over at 70 miles an hour. Pieces flew. There was some plastic involved in it. I saw metal in my rearview mirror as it bounced out from under my tire. I had no idea what it was. It was a good bump, though, when I ran over it. And I thought, oh, no. I am going to have a flat tire. I may blow out here in the middle of nowhere. And Sue is with me. Now, I've been in that situation a lot of times. But it's totally different if my wife is with me. Because now I don't have to just be concerned about the vehicle and getting something done. I got to be concerned about her. How do I make sure that everything is okay for her? Thank the Lord. I made it to San Jose. The tire didn't go flat. Was able to go to and from the place I stayed, the place that we stayed, do the meeting. Drove home Sunday afternoon. Everything was fine. Monday morning, got up, went out to go somewhere, and I had a flat tire on the pickup. And I thank God. You know, I don't enjoy having a flat tire, but I thank God that I didn't get stuck in the middle of nowhere with my wife and have to figure out how to resolve this and not have her be in a bad situation. And in the past, when I had children at home, it was even worse. Because not only was I concerned about her well-being, I was concerned about their well-being as well. This is inevitable. And it's what he's talking about. And a man by himself, like Paul, he can go out there and get beat up, and he can get out there and go hungry, and he can go out there and be shipwrecked, and he can get up and do it again. But how many shipwrecks are you going to go through with your family before you decide, I don't think I ought to be doing this. I think I probably need to take care of my family. You see, there is advantage in this. Paul was not in any way undervaluing the value, the real potential of a man on his own, faithful to the Lord, capable of doing good service, and not having other ties to this world. It was a powerful thing. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. We should all put the Lord first in our lives. But that doesn't mean we don't have other entanglements and responsibilities in the family. We do. And we're later going to be talking about the fifth chapter of 1 Timothy that talks about some of those family obligations as well. But a married man has concern how to please his wife. And that doesn't just mean how to make her happy. It means how to meet her needs, how to see to it that things are all right with her. His interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world. Husband or wife, it's the same. There's a concern there with being married. Caring about each other means caring about things that you otherwise might not care about. And that's an inevitable part of marriage. You need, you know, a bigger income. If you're going to have a family to feed, than what you need if you're just on your own. But that also translates into some of what's wrong in our current culture. There are a lot of people who have thought that through and said, well, if I had a wife and children, then that would cut into my ability to do all the things I want to do. And selfishness, rather than godliness, has caused a lot of people to choose not a chaste lifestyle, but a single lifestyle. And that's not at all admirable when selfishness leads people into a lifestyle of waste and wanton behavior. I'm not going to dwell on these questions, but I decided to throw them up here. Some of the questions that probably should be considered before a marriage takes place. Things like, where will you live after getting married? And I'll openly confess that when I proposed to my wife, okay, I didn't propose to my wife. That didn't actually happen. When I decided to work as an evangelist, to work to help churches, my wife, who was not yet anything but my girlfriend, said, well, I'll go with you and help you. And I said, well, I guess we should get married then. It was pretty much how that particular event went. But it was a romantic location. It was an evening sitting by a fountain, you know. It was a romantic location. But, you know, it's good to think in terms of what are we getting into, where are we going. Think about where you're going to live after getting married. Will the bride work outside the home? If so, for how long? Are children planned? How many? How soon? How far apart? We planned on 6 until we had 4. And, you know, these are things. It's true. When we had our 4th one, I didn't think we were necessarily done until I looked one day and saw how tired my wife was. And I said, I guess 4 is really probably enough for us. And so we didn't have any more after that. But they're all great and wonderful. And I'm glad we have them. But, you know, you talk about these kinds of things. I remember laying on the grass looking at the sky, talking to my girlfriend about the kind of family that we would want to have, how many children we would have, and so on and so forth. And those are good things. Will the wife work outside the home after babies come? And how soon will she do that? And it's important to be on the same page on things like this. And I really admire families in this age of double income. Now, for a while, the phrase was double income, no kids, because there were so many people doing that, just trying to have it all. But you can't have it all in that situation. But nevertheless, I admire those who are still determined enough, able enough to live on a single income and to raise a family. That's a good thing, to be willing and able to do that. And how will the children be disciplined? How will the children be provided for? How will they be trained and educated? It's good to be thinking alike on these kinds of things. What church will you attend? Religious questions should be answered before the marriage altar and not afterward. You should know. I've known of some people who had wonderful marriages with a believer to an unbeliever. I think they made a mistake in making that marriage in the first place, but nevertheless, they've had good marriages. I've known people where an unbeliever became a believer after many years in the marriage, and that's wonderful, but it would have been more wonderful if it would have been settled before entering into the marriage in the first place, because I've also known the contrary. I've known marriages where an unbeliever dragged a believer away. I've known marriages where an unbeliever made various promises about what they would do after the wedding and didn't live up to those promises. And there are lots and lots of other things that you could talk about in that area. We have a sister in the church who was not a religious person when she got married. But she was open to the idea. She thought, well, one of these days I may investigate this and find out I really want to be involved with the church. And so she had conversation with her husband about that. And he told her, well, if you ever pick a church, I'll go with you. She's been coming to church with us for about 5 years now. He's never been there yet and simply refuses. You know, but when she later indeed found that she believed things that she was hearing in some funerals and some Bible studies and circumstances, she became a believer, but her husband ended up not being too open to that after all. These kinds of things, again, are better, and she really did actually try to have some openness on that from the position she was in at the time, but good to have those kinds of issues, religious issues, settled before entering into marriage. How will the roles of husband and wife differ? Well, these things do change over time, but they need to change by consensus, by agreement, rather than by dictate. When Sue and I got married, we had no children. We both were full-time college students. We both had part-time jobs, and a lot of things were equal in the household. We both did laundry, but she did it way better. We both cooked, but she did it way better. You know, there were a lot of tasks that we shared that we took turns at. And over the years, as I had different responsibilities and as we had children, there were more and more differentiation. It used to be that I took care of all the checkbook and finances and stuff, and eventually I turned that over to her, except for doing taxes. And I don't know why I can't get her to do the taxes. But anyway, actually I do know why, but it's not pertinent. But the roles of husbands and wives differ. They need to be, you know, kind of anticipated, and they will change over time. I noticed that Sue kind of lost interest in cooking for large crowds of people, and I had a habit of inviting large crowds of people, and so I decided maybe I should learn a little bit more about how to pitch in on that and make that kind of work. And by the way, name some cooks, you know, in the Bible. Yeah. Martha. Jacob. Abraham at least told a servant, a man servant, to fix a fatted calf, while Sarah made the bread, yeah. But Jacob and Esau, they're both cooks, right? Jacob made the stew, probably lentils, the stew that he fed to Esau, and Esau was renowned for his barbecue. You know, make me the savory game that you make so well that Isaac wanted him to make. And their mother was a good cook because she was able to imitate Esau's style and do that. Yeah, those kinds of things are things that are not particularly dictated by male or female. They're things that are basically open to working out. How will the roles of husband and wife differ? What relationship do you expect to have with both sets of parents or in-laws? And Michael Manning, I'm going back to again, mentioned the other day that his wife has become more like his mother in many ways over the years. And he said that was a good thing, right? I agree with that. It has been said, you know, before you marry a woman, you should take a good look at her mother because, you know, that's kind of where she's going. And I wouldn't state that too emphatically because, I better not go there. It doesn't always happen that way, but you really should pay attention to the other person's family. And if you have big issues with their family, you may have big issues that you haven't realized yet with that person. Jay? Probably not.
Whom we marry is probably the second most important decision we'll ever make.
That's right. Jay says the person we marry is probably the second most important decision we'll ever make. The first being
to follow the Lord.
Yeah. The first being to follow the Lord. But how will you spend big family holidays? And do you agree on what the big family holidays are anyway? You know, these are some areas that need to be thought about. Who will make financial decisions? How will they be made? Who will write checks and keep the books? How do you feel about credit? That's going to be in a lesson next week. What physical limits have you set to keep until the marriage? Sometimes when people make a commitment to be married, it seems like some of the standards start to slip a little bit as they approach the wedding date. And it's a good idea to really set the standards high on keeping yourself chaste prior to the wedding, to make sure that you're on stable ground there. If the bride and groom have different friends, how will you relate to them? And there's a lot of friends that probably just need to be left behind and forgotten. And what are the greatest concerns or fears about your spouse-to-be, and what do you expect of your future mate? Again, I'm not going to dwell on those things, but those kinds of questions are things that need to be thought about and need to be addressed before carrying through on the decision to marry someone. In Psalm 127, the psalmist wrote, "Unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain." Now, what have I said is the number one word for family in the Bible? House. Okay, whether Old Testament or New Testament. Unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. The title that I was given was the family, and then in the print schedule it's the Christian family. And just to think in terms of the idea of having God involved in the home, is that good or bad? Well, that's a positive. That's a strength. That's an asset, to have God involved in the family. One of the things that Paul mentioned back there in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, and about the 5th verse, was, you know, it's okay for a husband and wife to agree to be separate from each other, physically separate from each other, for a time, he says, so that you can dedicate yourself to devotion, to prayer, to fasting, to things that have to do with godliness. And that's a real blessing in a family, in a marriage, to be on the same page. I think I've used that expression too many times today, but to have the same outlook, the same frame of reference when it comes to godliness, and to be able to pray together, to be able to share together in matters of serious concern, to share together in spiritual things. Unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. We want God involved in our family, in our marriages. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. We need God's help to safely secure those things that have been entrusted to us. And we consider that they have indeed been entrusted to us. In vain you rise up early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat, for he grants sleep to those he loves. You can waste a lot of time and effort on things that don't matter very much. God wanted his people in the Old Testament to show that they trusted him by honoring the seventh day. What lesson were they to learn by having the seventh day as a day of no work? Well, among other things, it was a lesson in trust. Well, if you can plant this much in 6 days, couldn't you plant that much more in 7 days? Well, forget about it. Plant for 6 days, rest on the seventh day, and trust the Lord that your needs will be met. And Jesus encourages the same kind of trust in his people when he says in Matthew 6:33, to seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added to you. Paul says that a man who's married is not only concerned about the things of the Lord, he's also concerned about the things of the world. But he better still be concerned about the things of the Lord. Keep the Lord in the forefront. Jay has pointed it out, reminded us again that the most important decision is to follow the Lord. And the things we do in the context of the family are tremendously important, but only as they follow after our decision to follow the Lord. And then he says in verse 3, and Samuel, this is about you, "Sons are a heritage from the Lord, children a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are sons born in one's youth." And I said the other day, if I had any of my sons here, I wouldn't hesitate to publicly embarrass them or whatever else it might take. I wouldn't hesitate to do that. I've done it lots of times. Because sons, children, are a reward and a heritage from the Lord, and they are a part of our armament and our equipment. I'm thrilled that God gave me 4. And I'm glad they're sons, but I would have been glad if they were girls too, if they were daughters. I don't have any real experience with that, other than now daughters-in-law and granddaughters, and that's a delight. But the other day, I was at D.D. Russell's house. Friday was his 69th birthday, I believe. And he had several granddaughters who were over there, teens and, you know, that age bracket. And they decided that they were going to make a cake for Grandpa's birthday. He was out working. He went out early that morning. He was out all day long. But they decided they were going to make a cake for his birthday. So they made a cake for his birthday. And then they decided, well, we got nothing else to do. Let's make a pie for his birthday. So they made a pie for his birthday, peach pie, chocolate cake, peach pie. And then Grandma came home, and Grandma didn't know they'd done what they'd already done, and said, "How about we make a strawberry pie for your Grandpa's birthday?" And they said, "All right, let's make a strawberry pie for Grandpa's birthday." Anyway, When I talked to my wife on the phone that night, I said, you know, our lives would have been totally different if we would have had girls instead of boys. They would have been good. It would have been good, but our lives would have been completely different if we would have had girls instead of having boys. And it was fun. That was a pleasure to see. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be put to shame when they contend with their enemies in the gate. It's good to have your family as allies. It's good to have your family sharing your values. It's good to have your family willing to work with you on the things that really matter. It's a great blessing of God to have a family that is also valuing the things of the Lord, also wanting to participate in the encouragement of the saints and the edification. And Samuel, I mentioned you up here twice, but it's because I like and admire you, actually. Don't let it get out, but think you're doing really good. And I'm glad. I'm very glad that you can do some of those things. And as far as that value judgment, which one sings better? Well, you guys sing differently, but you sure sing more like him than I would have ever thought you would. What? That's what you keep hearing. Yeah. Yeah. What is that? What would you make of that? Yesterday and today, that's part of it. Yeah, what? Contrast, yes. Contrast, yeah. What do we have on that side of the screen? Yeah, the Cleaver family from Leave It to Beaver TV show. And then what's the other one? The Simpsons, yeah. Bart and company, the Simpsons. And both of those are the same thing, you know, an American family. Comedy, right? Yeah. And I don't have a lot to say about that. I just kind of wanted to draw a contrast. Yes, I did. A then and now contrast. And it's not even a value judgment here as I put it up here. It's a things have changed picture, okay? Things have changed. Don't think things haven't changed. Things have changed. And we're not done yet. You know, the change is ongoing, and that's what we're going to continue to talk about over the next few days.